I'm going to begin us with a prayer, and then we'll begin our last chat about what grace is. Holy and gracious God, Lord, we thank you for bringing us here today. And we thank you, Lord, for giving us the opportunity to talk about grace and to talk about how you and it fills our lives. Lord, as we gather, as we chat, as we consider, help us, Lord, to listen for your voice so that we wouldn't just hear the voice that runs in our head of what our thoughts are, but help us to listen for your voice that speaks through it. And Lord, we ask this in Christ's name. Amen. Well, before I begin talking about the stuff for today, last week we talked about a number of things related to grace. We talked about grace, and we talked about healing, and we talked about salvation, and we talked about really in many ways how just the accretions, the buildup of things over the years has actually changed the original understanding of things like salvation and our understanding of faith. But does anybody, before we move on, does anybody have any questions or thoughts or anything they'd like to clarify or think through before I move on for the stuff for today? Okay, well then what I want to do here for the final day is I want to talk about gratitude, grace, and how to grow in the sense of grace in our lives. And I want to begin with a quote from a guy named David Stendhal Rost. David Stendhal Rost is a Benedictine brother who's also a Catholic priest. And he's written a lot in the area of spirituality. And he has this wonderful, in his book, Gratefulness, the Heart of Prayer, he says, "What counts on your path to fulfillment is that we remember the great truth that moments of surprise want to teach us. Everything is gratuitous. Everything is gift. The degree to which we are awake to this truth is the measure of our gratefulness. And gratefulness is the measure of our aliveness. In moments when we are truly alive, we experience life as a gift. We also experience life as surprise." What do you hear in this quote from Stendhal Rost? What stands out to you in it?
The surprise.
What's that?
Surprise element.
The surprise element, yeah. That it's there, but it catches us by surprise. What else?
Life as a gift.
What's that?
Life as a gift.
Life as a gift. I mean, are these the ways we often think about life? I mean, often we think about life maybe as difficult or as tedium or as just a lot of things. But this is actually saying it's a gift that's there, and it's a gift that's always there to surprise us. What else stands out to you in this?
You're never quite sure of the next day.
What's that?
Life is a surprise.
Yeah, that life is a surprise all the time. The reason why I wanted to bring this out is because, to me, something that we don't necessarily recognize is what the connection is between gratitude and grace. I think that one of the problems in just life, but it's especially true in American culture, we often take things for granted. We live in a world of abundance, and everybody runs around acting like we're in a world of scarcity. We live in a world where people have so much, and yet people feel like they don't have enough. Then what happens is, instead of being grateful for things in our lives, what happens is we often have a sense of ungratefulness, of this sense of, I want more. As my brother has said, I don't know why his favorite phrase is this, you know, what you have is good, but more is better. And that's not necessarily true. That sometimes what happens is, the more we get, the more it numbs us to what's already there. And that can be a huge difficulty for a lot of us because we lack gratitude. Going back throughout the Christian spiritual writing, the Christian spiritual tradition, there has always been an understanding that there is a deep connection between gratitude and grace. And it actually comes through in the word. The word gratitude literally comes from the root gratis, which means grace, and tude, which is a condition or a quality or whatever. In other words, when we live life with a sense of gratitude, we live in a state of grace. We live in a state where we begin to recognize grace all around us. Equally, if we live with a sense of entitlement, or we live with a sense of ingratitude, of not recognizing everything around us and not being grateful, what happens is we live in a state where grace may be all around, but grace doesn't really penetrate our lives because we're just so closed off to it. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there a distinction between that and jealousy?
Between what and jealousy?
Wanting to have a, you know...
Well, I think jealousy is an extension of ingratitude. It's not only am I not grateful for what I have, but now what happens is I covet what somebody else has, or who somebody else is, or the talent they have. That what happens is we're not grateful for what we have, but instead what happens is we want what others have. And it's, you know, it's a defensive emotion. It's a protective emotion. Other thoughts about this? Basically, grateful also, it comes from the Latin gratis and full, being full. That when you go around in life and you are grateful for the things in your life slowly starts to become more full of grace. But you already know the problem with this is that as you get immersed in everything in life, you know, your kids bug you, your spouse bugs you, people at work bug you, your work bugs you, people that you're behind on the road bug you, people that you're in front of on the road and they tailgate you, they bug you. It bugs you that the Steelers haven't won the Super Bowl every year since 1974. It bugs you when the Penguins lose 5-1 to the St. Louis Blues. It begins to bug you when everything happens. And the difficulty is that as that happens, instead of being grateful and looking at what's good, what happens is we become ungrateful. And when we become ungrateful, it becomes like a force field. It doesn't nullify God's grace. It doesn't mean God's grace isn't in life. But what it can do is act like a force field that almost deflects grace. You know, that one of the things I've noticed is, just think in your mind, who is the most grateful person you know? Think of somebody who you think is a grateful person. What do you notice about what they experience in life?
Well, I'd say they're joyful.
They're joyful.
They're
yeah.
Happy with whatever.
They experience life as joyful.
They find it.
Yeah, and they find it. What else do you notice? Yeah.
I think they experience goodness and fullness.
They experience goodness and fullness in everything. Now, think of the most ungrateful person you know. The most cynical, pessimistic person you know. What do you notice about that person's life? It's miserable. Everything seems to go wrong. There's a connection between the sense of gratitude we have. You know, one of the things that I find has been really interesting as a pastor. As a pastor, it can be really extremely frustrating to visit grateful people in a hospital. Now, why? Because you're in there to help them feel better about whatever's going on, and they already feel better. Do you know how frustrating that is? Much easier to work with someone who's like, I feel miserable, and you're trying to help them feel better than it is when you go in and somebody says, well, yeah, you know, I have this, but you know, there's so many people who are worse off than me. And I still experience God in all of it. Incredibly frustrating as a pastor. I'll tell you, if Louise ever comes and visits you, no matter how grateful you are, pretend you're not, it'll actually help her to feel more grateful. Because we pastors, we want to help. Go ahead.
When you talk about grateful and gratitude and somebody who is ungrateful, miserable, I can't help but think that there may be, whether there might be a linguistic connection between miser and miserable.
Yes, absolutely. Miser and miserable, the connection, I would imagine. Somebody wants to look up miser and get us a definition, but I think that's true, is people who become self-protective. You know, one of the things that I found interesting, I did research about 10 years ago on the impact of wealth on people, and it found that no matter how much money people make, they say they won't feel comfortable until they get at least 50% more. And it's an amazing stat, because by and large what it means is if you make $500,000 a year, you won't feel comfortable until you make $1 million a year. If you make $1 million a year, you won't feel comfortable until you make $2 million a year. There are people that they interviewed for some of these studies. There was a Yale professor, and I can't remember his name. I think his last name was Lane, but I'm not sure, who did a study on this, and he interviewed the super rich. And he found that those who were worth about $500 million said that they would not really feel comfortable until they had at least $1 billion. And that people who had $1 billion would not feel comfortable until they had at least $2 billion. And it's you know, that what happens is that the more we have, often the more we feel like we have to protect it. Meanwhile, gratitude basically says, appreciate and be thankful for what you have. Let me share several other quotes from about gratitude. Thomas a Kempis was a 14th century Roman Catholic priest and spiritual director who wrote, "So be grateful for every little gift, and you will be worthy to receive greater ones. Consider the least gift as great, and the most common as something special. If you consider the dignity of the giver, no gift will seem small or unimportant. Nothing given by the Most High God is insignificant. And if he should send you pain and sorrow, you ought to be thankful too, for whatever he permits, he does for our own good. The person who wishes to keep God's grace should be thankful when it was given and should be patient when it is taken away. Pray for its return and then be cautious, humble, and humble lest it be lost." What do you hear in this? Or what phrases stand out? Yeah. What?
The least gift.
Yeah.
The gift. It's usually the one you're not expecting.
Yeah. And be grateful for it. And you know, not only consider the gift, but consider the person who's giving it and what their experience is. Let me move to another. This is from Adrian Von Kahm and Susan Muto from their book, The Power of Appreciation. Adrian Von Kahm is actually a man I studied with at Duquesne for my PhD. Susan Muto runs the Epiphany Association, which is, it's not too far from here. I think it's in Beachview, but I'm not sure. They talk about appreciation, and that's their word for gratitude. And they say, appreciative thinking enables you to see the crisis that emerges in your daily, everyday life, not as obstacles leading to defeat, but as opportunities offering new directions by which to reshape your dreams. The power of appreciation gives you the practical means you need to make the best of an always somewhat bad deal. Life is never a rose garden free of thorns. Anyone who plants seeds know that weeds spring up besides the flowers. Our approach seeks to convince you that the power of appreciation rests within you. You can make this power work for you in any crisis. It challenges you to show courage, candor, and conviction instead of complaining, denying the good things in your life, and losing faith. What does this say to you? Or what phrases or lines stand out to you? Yeah.
Well, that's a lot more negative than the first Kempis's.
Really? What's more negative about it?
You're always going to get a raw deal, so.
Well, I don't think that's what. Does everybody else sort of experience that word crisis as a raw deal?
Well, it has more of a negative connotation.
Well, the impression I get from this is, appreciative thinking enables you to see the crises that emerge in your everyday life not as obstacles leading to defeat, but as opportunities offering new directions. It seems to me that I may be reading this wrong, but it seems to me that what they're saying is crises just come up. Mm-hmm. You know, a hot water tank blows apart. Somebody gets an illness. But so it seems to me they're not saying you're just going to get a raw deal. They're just saying this is what life is. This is what happens in life. But it seems to me they're saying that you can look at these not as obstacles to things, but as opportunities for new growth. You may be seeing it differently. I don't necessarily see it as more negative. I think it's actually taking a second step, which is saying even through crises, there are opportunities in crises. And if you think about how most people change their lives, usually it doesn't come when nothing's going on. But if you think of most major changes in life, they come about when we're going through a difficult time. But anyway, go ahead, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not only is the glass is half full, but actually it's an opportunity to also go back to the sink and fill it to the top. Other thoughts? Yeah.
These quotes are making me think about the sliding doors, the automatic sliding doors at the state store.
Okay.
So sometimes you go up to an automatic door and you just step up to the store and whoa, it opens up before you. You kind of get used to that.
Yep.
Right. Automatically. And then I have to look around, like, how else am I going to get in there? And then you have to work at the door.
Yeah, it's awful.
I mean, I'm taking muscles are another used. Step about other situations
yeah.
that you think are going to happen, and they don't happen
yeah.
automatically. And you have to work at them and make a decision to try to get past the obstacle that wasn't automatic.
Yeah, yeah. And it forces you to take different looks too.
Yeah, and it forces me to look at my attitude because sometimes I just want to laugh. Like, I can't believe you thought that door was gonna.
Well, yeah, but this is what happens in life. Let me move to a next one, a final one, and then I want to show you something else. It's another quote. Many people get so wrapped up in their lives that they never take time to recognize how much God is in their lives, let alone how much God has blessed them. It is very easy to either take things for granted or worse, to become cynical. When we do either, we miss how much God is working in our lives. Like a beautiful sunset, you have to actually look to be inspired. The same is true with God's blessings. God has blessed you, and God is blessing you still. But you have to look to see. How do you say thank you to God for all of God's blessings in your life? Do you say thank you? One of the most important ways to increase God's power in our lives comes from appreciating God and being grateful to God. It comes from looking at all the blessings in our lives, even if we're having a hard time, and thanking God for what we have, for children, spouses, friends, opportunities, careers, abilities, insights, and especially our church. What comes out in this quote? Yeah.
Being thankful.
That actually being thankful opened you up to God. One of the practices that I developed, a spiritual practice I developed in my life, is just what I call a gratitude walk. Often it's just you walk, you know, you just take a walk and thank God. You know, you reflect on your life and thank God for everything in it, but also look around and thank God for everything that you're seeing around you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No thanks, wow. And that has sort of become a little mantra for me, you know, when I'm walking or doing something,
yeah.
I kind of look around and see, oh, I need help with this, oh, wow, look at that, thanks for that.
Yeah.
It's just a quick way to remind me.
And doing that, it connects you with grace. I mean, that's really the point. It's not just you begin to notice things, but it connects you with grace. I had somebody years ago came to Calvin Church, and she was an agnostic, and she started coming to church and wanted and basically said, you know, I never really experienced God. You know, how do I experience God? And we talked for a while, and I said, well, I'd like you to do an exercise. Even though you're not going to be inclined to do it, I'd like you to basically pray for 2 or 3 minutes, 3 times a day over the course of 40 days. And I said, you can pray about anything, but you can also pray for God to reveal God's self. And she did. And she said, you know, the first week she felt like she was just wasting her time. And she said, the second week, what happened was she started doing it. And she said, again, she's not feeling anything great from God, but she said it was like an experience of lifting her head up from looking at the floor. She said all of a sudden she just sort of began to notice things a little bit more. She said by the third week, she said she began, and she lives on a farm, and she said she began to just have a, you know, all of a sudden she said it just felt like colors were becoming a little bit deeper. And she said just plants were becoming more vibrant. And she said by the fourth week, she realized that was the experience of God. And eventually she ended up becoming a member of the church and became an elder and went to seminary and is now a pastor. But her experience was that just by praying and being aware, it just opened things up. Yeah.
We have to take time.
We do have to take time.
To save
time. We do, and when we're in a hurry. So Carl Jung said, hurry is not of the devil, it is the devil. That what happens is we become in such a hurry in our lives. And there are opportunities in that hurriedness. I mean, for one of the things for me, since I left Calvin Church and I had 22 years of a cushy 5-minute commute, I now have a 25 to 30 minute commute. And basically in the morning, I've turned that into prayer time. It just becomes an opportunity to pray. But it's very easy to not, you know, to start thinking about everything and, you know, listening to things and, you know, depending on what you're listening to either get caught up into it or to get irritated with it or whatever it is. I want to show a 20-minute film clip. This is a film clip that I picked up about 18 years ago. You're going to ask me, you may ask me afterwards, well, how do I get a copy of the video? You can't. The reason why is it comes from a company that licenses these things, and 18 years ago, both I bought it and our church bought it, and it's like $300 and something dollars. I think the price is up to $600 now. But if you want a version of it, the guy's name is DeWitt Jones, and he's also done a TED Talk based on this, so you can find an 18-minute TED Talk. It's something that that we had a guest speaker at Calvin Church who showed it, and afterwards I was like, this is amazing, because I think this really shows the connection between a sense of appreciation, a sense of gratitude, and a sense of grace in life. Even though he doesn't really talk about God and doesn't really talk about grace, everything he's talking about really fits with that. So the guy's name is DeWitt Jones, and he was, I think he's retired now, but he was a photographer for National Geographic.
I'm DeWitt Jones. For 20 years, I worked for National Geographic, photographing stories all over the globe, creating extraordinary visions. I learned a great deal from these visions about society, about geography, about people. But the vision that most changed my life was not photographic. It was an attitude, a perspective that exists at the core of the Geographic. A vision so simple, yet so profound. A vision I'd like to share with you. Celebrate what's right with the world. We all have teachers in our lives, mentors that show us what's possible, The National Geographic was one of those for me. Maybe it was for many of you. You know, I used to read it at night. And even after my parents told me to turn out the light and go to sleep, I wouldn't do it. I'd get a flashlight. I'd hide under the covers. I'd stay up and stare at those photos in that little yellow book. Pictures that showed me the possibilities the world had to offer. I never thought I'd work for them. I never thought I'd shoot for them. They began to influence my life long before I even knew I was a photographer. Why? Because they had a wonderful vision. What they charged me with every time they sent me out was to celebrate what was right with the world rather than wallow in what was wrong with it. That's why we keep them. We all do. I mean, it's a national sacrilege to throw away a Geographic because they celebrate what's right with the world. And nobody wants to throw that away. When I was growing up, I used to hold that maxim, I won't believe it until I see it. Yet the more I shot for the Geographic, the more I realized that I had it backwards. That the way it really works is, I won't see it till I believe it. That's the way life works. Well, I believed it. I believed the vision of the Geographic, and the more I did, the more I'd see it and everything. They'd send me out to places I'd never been. I believed there would be beautiful landscapes to photograph. They'd appear. I believed those landscapes would be full of wonderful people. They'd be there. I'd begin every assignment, every day, every shot, trying to celebrate what was right with the situation rather than what was wrong with it. When I started, I had no idea how powerful that vision would be, how much it would change my life. But vision controls our perception, and our perception becomes our reality. Celebrating what's right with the world, it was a vision that had purpose and passion for everybody at the Geographic. Do you have a vision like that? Not just for your organization, for yourself. You know, a vision that you could put into six words that every morning when you say those words, you say, yes, that's why you're doing whatever it is you're doing. Because when the vision is clear, then passion and creativity are there as well. I know that. I know that because I lived it. All of a sudden, I wasn't just looking at those pictures on the printed page. I was there, and what an incredible place there was. From the highest mountains, to rivers drenched in sunlight, to rainbows and seashells. Everywhere I looked, there would be amazing beauty for me to photograph. And in the Geographic's view, man was an integral part of that beauty. Not something separate, just as beautiful, just as magical as anything else on the planet. And when I celebrated the best in people, I could see that. I could see it in the faces of those at work, or the body language of those at play, those in their youth, or in their age. Can you believe this guy? I thought this was going to be a good shot before he smiled. I would see it. I would see that light that shines not on us, but from within us. From within us when we trust enough to let it out. It was the same light I'd seen in nature that didn't have to trust to expose itself, but just graced us every day with the delicacy of a flower or the fading light on Half Dome. Yet the more I celebrated the beauty of the world, the more I found a conflict growing within me between the Geographic's paradigm and the worldview that I'd been taught since I was a child, my intellectual paradigm. You all know it. The law of the jungle, eat or be eaten, my win is your loss, second place is the first loser. We live in that paradigm all the time, a world based on fear and scarcity and competition. It's true if you choose to believe it. But it wasn't what nature was showing me. Nature was showing me incredible beauty standing just beyond the rat race saying, hello, hello. All was there if I was open enough to see it. I mean, come on, nature never stood in front of a forest and said, there is one great photograph hidden here. One photographer will find it and the rest of you will be hopeless losers. Nature said, how many roles you got to win? Bring it on. Bring it on, I'll fill them up. I'll fill them up with layers of beauty and possibility beyond anything you've ever imagined. Right down to my tiniest seed. Do we choose to see those possibilities? Do we truly believe that they're there? Perception controls our reality, and if we don't believe it, we won't see it. I remember one time they sent me up to the Selkirk Mountains of British Columbia, and I came upon this great field of dandelions. But, you know, I just wasn't into it, and I started to say, "Yeah, the light isn't right. I'll come back tomorrow." We've all been there. It happens all the time, at home, at work. I just can't get into it. I'll do it tomorrow. And then tomorrow turns into next week, and by the time I got back there, no more dandelions. I had puffballs. That wasn't the way I planned it. And I was just about to leave when a little voice inside me said, "Come on, DeWitt, what's here to celebrate? I know it wasn't how you planned it, but what's right with the situation? Where are the possibilities?" And before I knew it, I was into puffballs. Puffballs, puffballs, over the puffballs, at eye level with the puffballs, under the puffballs, looking at them from every angle until, whoa! Oh, that's what I found. It was there. It seemed it was always there, if I was open enough to see it. The more I shot for the Geographic, the more I realized what a powerful force our vision can be. As I celebrated what was right with the world, I began to build a vision of possibility. Not scarcity, possibility. Always another right answer. A vision that showed me that no matter how bleak and desolate, no matter how dry and devoid of possibilities the situation might seem, that if I was open to it, I could always find a perspective. In this case, just by dropping down in that crack in the slick rock and looking back. A perspective that would transform the ordinary into the extraordinary. How open to possibility does our vision allow us to be? Open. I mean, really open, even when we think we know what the answer will be. I was shooting recently in Marine World, and I'd gotten the shots of the whales and the dolphins, and I'm heading back to the car, and I saw this kid standing in front of the dancing fountains. Dancing fountains, you know, where the water comes out of one, goes up and goes into the other and up and into the next one. And this kid had his hand on the source. And he was ready, and so was I. And he was waiting, and so was I. And I knew what that answer would be, and I nailed it. But I'm not putting on the brakes. I'm not taking my eye off the viewfinder. I'm staying open. Because if I didn't, if I thought this was it, I never would have seen this one. Celebrating what's right with the world. It not only keeps us open to possibilities, it gives us energy. When I'm setting up a shot, I always begin by saying, what's exciting me? What's here to celebrate? What's the very best this shot has to offer? And then I try and enhance that and get rid of everything else. Instead of starting out as we so often do by griping about what's wrong with the situation, what's right with it? Because by celebrating the best, that allows us to fall in love with it. That connects us with our passion. That emancipates the energy. By celebrating what's right, we find the energy to fix what's wrong. As Michelangelo once wrote, "I saw an angel in the stone and carved to set it free." Right vision. It keeps us open to possibilities, it gives us energy, and it makes us much more accepting of change. Change. Boy, as a photographer, I'd pray for change. I'd get down on my knees and beg the weather or the wind or the light to do its thing. It was the status quo that would make my pictures boring and redundant. In fact, I began to see that the very thing that so often frightens us today, that awesome change curve we hear so much about, the phenomenal rate of change in our society, was really my ally. In fact, if I viewed it from just a slightly different perspective, it wasn't a change curve at all. It was a possibility curve. A possibility curve. Could I see it like that? I knew from my photography that it was true. Change is possibility, and the times of most change always hold the most potential. So we live in an accelerating possibility curve. Perhaps we can't control it, but we can learn to ride it like a surfer on a wave or a bird on a thermal, to use its power to take us where we want to go, to live in uncertainty and yet act with confidence. Now that's something I could celebrate. And the more I did, the more I took all my skills and used them to ride that wave of possibility, the more I found in my photography and in my life that the difference between a good frame and a great frame is measured in millimeters, not miles. Good frame, a morning glory on a beach in Maui, 10 inches closer. Great frame. Good frame, a cowboy in Bryce Canyon, 30 feet away in the doorway of a barn. Great frame. Good frame, sunset on the Golden Gate Bridge with the new moon rising. How could it get any better? 15 minutes later. Great frame. When we believe it, we'll see it. The power of vision is extraordinary. It transforms the way we look at the world. It can take us from flapping in the middle of the flock to soaring to heights we've never dreamed of. But we have to be willing to trust it, to come out to our edge. Because it's here on the edge that we find the winds to take us higher. And it's not just the external edges that we have to test. It's the internal ones as well. If we're going to really learn to soar, we have to know ourselves as well as we know our craft. I realized that if I was going to take it higher in my own life, I had to spend time not just with what I do, but with who I am. Boy, that's a lot harder, at least it was for me, discovering who I was and being comfortable with it. A lot harder than taking a photograph. And yet I knew that was the move from good frame to great frame. That was the edge I'd have to press. That edge in each of our lives between success and significance. That subtle edge between being the best in the world and being the best for the world. Not an easy shift. But every time that I'd lose faith that I might ever be able to make it, I'd meet someone who had. And they'd serve as a beacon to show me it was possible. I met such a person on Scotland's Outer Hebrides. Her name was Marion Campbell, and she was the finest weaver in all of Scotland. She was a national treasure. She'd been sighted by the Queen, and she lived in the tiny town of Plockropool. And I had to photograph her, and I went to her house. I knocked on the door. She came out, lovely woman. And she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm from National Geographic, and I want to photograph you." And she said, "Wait. My brother is very sick upstairs. He may be dying. And I'm taking care of him." I felt like a complete idiot, you know. I mean, why? I began to apologize. I backed off. And she stopped me and she said, wait. Give me an hour and I'll be ready. And she closed the door. And I wandered around the village thinking of the extraordinary presence of this woman. Why, when her brother was dying, would she give me time? And then I heard the hand shuttle being thrown across her loom, and I found her in her weaving shed, lit only by the light of the window. And she showed me the yarn that she'd spun by hand. And she told me how she'd gone into the fields and scraped the lichens off the rock to make her dyes. And I was still nervous and embarrassed. I took a few quick photographs, and I said, thank you, fine, I got it. And I started to leave, and again she stopped me, and she took me into her house. And she'd put out biscuits, and she'd made tea, and she wouldn't eat till I had eaten. And she invited me into her living room, and she stoked the peat fire, and we sat together.
And she talked quietly and simply, and I kept thinking I was in the presence of a great sage, and I was waiting for some great gift of wisdom. And finally I said, "What do you think about when you weave?" And she said, "I wonder if I'll run out of thread." It wasn't exactly what I thought I'd hear, you know. And she must have seen my discomfort, because she smiled at me and she cocked her head and she said, "When I weave, I weave." And in my own mind I heard, "When I weave, I weave. When I photograph, I photograph. When I serve, I serve. When I celebrate, I celebrate." There's no use walking anywhere to preach unless you're walking as you're preaching. And that evening, through her actions and her words, Marion Campbell showed me what it might be like to soar. She was who she was, with discipline, with grace, with total lack of ego. She was a thermal rider, not just the best in the world, but the best for the world. Could I do that? Could I trust my own values and vision enough to step out beyond my own edge? To find a new balance in my life, not one of limitation, but one of possibility. Not an either-or balance, but a both-and balance between what I do and who I am. A balance that would allow me to keep all of my intensity and focus, and at the same time not lose sight of those things that were really important in my life. A balance that would allow me to take it all in till I was full to overflowing, and then with gratitude and with grace to give it all back. To be like the sunset that nature graces us with every evening. To put it all out there, to publish it in my life, the very best I had to offer without any regard to whether it was received or not. I know that whenever I can do this, wonderful things happen. I photographed the Highland Games in Scotland for an advertising campaign for Dewar Scotch. And we were photographing these huge guys throwing these weights around. It was great fun, but you know, I couldn't get my eye off the guy with the coat. He was the judge. And we shot some wonderful ads, but my intuition is just screaming at me to go meet this guy. So when it was over, I went up to him and I said, "Have you ever done this before? You're bigger than all the rest of these guys." And he said, "Aye, laddie, aye. I was the champion of Scotland for many years." And I said, "Well, what do you do now?" And he said, "Well, I'm a farmer. I was a farmer then. I'm still a farmer now." I said, "Well, can I come and visit you?" He said, "Well, I guess you could." And so I dragged my whole crew down there the next day, and big boy. And we found this weight, you know, that he hadn't thrown in years, and we took him out in his front field, and talk about being your own banquet. He was just lost in the very best that he had to offer. And so was I. I mean, I didn't care if I was getting paid or shooting for doers. I was just falling in love through the lens, celebrating what's right with the world. And the art director took those pictures and turned them into this ad that said, "For 25 years, Henry Gray won the cheers of the crowd at Scotland's Highland Games. And even now, he likes to get out and throw his weight around in the privacy of his own backyard." This ad won all kinds of awards, but you know, I didn't care. I got to meet Henry. And a couple years later, we were back in Scotland and near where Henry lived. And so we stopped and we went over to his house. And he showed us how he'd framed up the ad that we'd sent him. And he and his wife came out in the front yard and posed for pictures. And then he said, "Come here, laddie, I want to show you something." And he turned that ad around, and it was covered with signatures. And I said, "Henry, what's this?" And he said, "Well, laddie, I ran that ad all over the world. And all of my relations in New Zealand and Australia and the U.S., they all saw it, and they all called, and they said, 'Henry, is that you?' And I said, 'Aye, it's me.' And they said, 'Well, we think we better come back and check on you.' And so because of that ad, they had the first Grey Clan reunion in more than 200 years. We never know where it's going to go when you publish it in your life, when you give it all back. You just have to do it and believe." You know, incredible things happen when we're open to possibilities. Because the world is an astounding place. I first saw that on the pages of the Geographic when I was a kid. We can see it now, every day, if we're open enough to it. If we hold a vision that fills us with energy, that takes us to our own edge and gives us the courage to soar, that allows us to celebrate what's right with the world.